Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you. Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
My nephew attends this school. When the blast happened, I ran out to see what was going on here, and I saw the students running out of the houses. There were a lot of people outside the school gate, and then another blast took place.
A prominent boys' high school in Kabul is targeted by two deadly bombings in the heart of the city's Shiite Hazara community. We'll get an update on the security situation in Afghanistan under the Taliban. Then, U.S. border officials have arrested a record of over 1 million asylum seekers in the past 6 months, while at the same time welcoming thousands of Ukrainian refugees fleeing Russia's invasion.
The current treatment of Ukrainian refugees at the border shows that the COVID-related border restrictions implemented under the Trump administration and expanded by the Biden administration were never about public health. Instead, they were meant to keep black and brown asylum seekers from seeking safety in the United States.
We'll go to Tijuana to speak with immigration attorney Erica Pinedo. She was surveilled and monitored under the Trump administration. And 1 week from today, Texas plans to execute Melissa Lucio for the death of her daughter, despite widespread concern she's innocent and a push by over 100 Texas lawmakers to spare her life, led in part by a Republican state lawmaker.
As a conservative Republican myself, who has long been a supporter of the death penalty in the most heinous cases, I have never seen a more troubling case than the case of Melissa Lucio.
We'll speak with the Innocence Project lawyer now fighting to save Lucio's life. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations Refugee Agency says 5 million people have fled Ukraine since the start of Russia's invasion. Another 7 million people are displaced inside Ukraine. Russia's rejected a call from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres for a four-day ceasefire. He'd called for the fighting to stop as Orthodox Christians in Russia and Ukraine prepare to mark Easter this Sunday.
Instead of celebration of a new life, this Easter coincides with the Russian offensive in eastern Ukraine. The intense concentration of forces and firepower makes this battle inevitably more violent, bloody, and destructive. The onslaught and terrible toll on civilians we have seen so far could pale in comparison to the horror that lies ahead. This cannot be allowed to happen.
Guterres was speaking in front of the knotted gun sculpture at the United Nations. This comes as Russian forces escalate shelling in eastern Ukraine in an attempt to capture the entire Donbas region. In the besieged southeastern city of Mariupol, Ukrainian forces and civilians remain holed up in a massive steel plant while Russia controls the rest of the city. Russia had set a deadline for all troops to lay down their arms today, but the deadline passed with the Ukrainian forces remaining inside. Meanwhile, an agreement has been reached to allow women, children, and elderly people to escape Mariupol through a humanitarian corridor. In other developments, the Biden administration is expected to announce a new $800 million military package for Ukraine, including artillery as well as anti-armor and anti-air equipment. As the West funnels weapons to Ukraine, the New York Times has revealed its uncovered evidence that Ukrainian forces fired banned cluster munitions in at least one town during its fight with Russian forces. The weapons are banned under the Convention on Cluster Munitions, though Ukraine, Russia, and the United States never signed the treaty. A prominent Russian banker who was recently sanctioned by the British government has called for an end to what he describes as, quote, this insane war. Oleg Tinkov, who now lives outside Russia, claimed 90% of Russians are against the war. Tinkov made the comments in an Instagram post. He wrote, quote, dear collective West, please give Mr. Putin a clear exit to save his face and stop this massacre. Please be more rational and humanitarian. He said. The World Food Program's warning 20 million people could go hungry in the Horn of Africa because of a massive drought and rising fuel and food prices due to the war in Ukraine. Last week, the UN projected 350,000 children in Somalia could die of starvation in the coming months if the world doesn't act quickly. The UN has been trying to raise $1.5 billion for its Somalia humanitarian response plan, but so far it's only been able to raise about 4% of that total. A British judge has ordered the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States, where he faces 175 years in prison. The final decision on Assange's extradition will now be made by the UK Home Secretary Priti Patel. Amnesty International's Simon Crowther spoke outside the courthouse prior to today's ruling.
Julian Assange is being prosecuted for espionage, for publishing sensitive material that was classified, and if he is extradited to the US for this, all journalists around the world are going to have to look over their shoulder, because within their own jurisdiction, if they publish something that the US considers to be classified, they will face the risk of being extradited.
The Justice Department is holding off on appealing a federal judge's ruling that struck down the Biden administration's mask mandate for travelers. On Tuesday, the Justice Department said it would appeal only if the CDC decides a mask mandate is still needed. On Tuesday, President Biden declined to urge passengers to continue wearing masks on planes.
Should people continue to wear masks on planes?
That's up to them.
Would you like to appeal the ruling that the judge made striking down that mandate?
I haven't spoken to the CDC yet.
In Sri Lanka, mass protests are continuing as the nation faces dire shortages of food, fuel and medicine. On Tuesday, one protester died after Sri Lankan police opened fire on protesters in the city of Rambukana. 12 protesters were reportedly hospitalized. Protesters are calling for Sri Lanka's president to resign.
We can't make ends meet. We have no electricity. We don't have gas. The price of rice has skyrocketed. We can't make ends meet. So we have no choice but to go on the streets. We took to the streets to throw this government out.
The Solomon Islands has signed a security deal with China, sparking criticism from the United States, Australia, and New Zealand. The text of the deal has not been released, but leaked documents indicate it could allow China to send troops and naval ships to the Pacific Island nation where a key battle in World War II was fought. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasa Sagavare spoke on Tuesday.
Let me assure the people of Solomon Islands that we entered into an arrangement with China with our eyes wide open, guided by our national interests. We have full understanding of the fragility of peace, and our duty as a state is to protect all people, their properties, and critical national infrastructures of the country.
The Biden administration has expressed alarm over the deal and is sending two top officials to the Solomon Islands this week. The U.S. is also moving to reopen an embassy in the Solomon Islands. State Department spokesperson Ned Price addressed the issue Monday.
That signing such an agreement could increase destabilization within the Solomon Islands and will set a concerning precedent for the wider Pacific Island region.
In East Timor, Timor-Leste, the Nobel Peace Laureate José Ramos Horta has taken a commanding lead in Tuesday's presidential election over incumbent Francisco Luolo Guterres. With almost half of the votes counted, Ramos Horta has about 59% of the vote. José Ramos Horta previously led East Timor from 2007 to 2012. A Catholic diocese in southern New Jersey has agreed to pay $87.5 million to settle hundreds of sexual abuse claims dating back to the 1950s. The settlement comes 3 years after the Diocese of Camden, New Jersey, acknowledged 56 of its priests and one deacon had been credibly accused of sexual abuse. The U.S. Department of Education has announced changes to two student loan programs to fix what the department described as long-standing failures. With the changes, about 40,000 people will have their debts forgiven. Another 3.6 million borrowers will receive some credit toward their debts owed. The moves come as the Biden administration faces growing pressure to cancel all federal student debt. Student debt cancellation would give relief to some 45 million people who owe nearly $1.8 trillion in student loans. New government data shows the United States has arrested more than a million migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border since October. It's the highest total in at least 20 years. Meanwhile, disturbing details have emerged about the death of a Mexican mother who died last week as she tried to cross into the United States. Griselda Verduzco-Varmenta tried to climb over a 30-foot-high border fence near Douglas, Arizona. But she choked to death after getting entangled in a climbing harness. Border authorities found her hanging upside down on the border fence. One relative claimed Griselda tried to cross the border with the help of coyotes who then left her hanging once she got entangled. The U.S. Justice Department is considering taking control of the New York City jail complex at Rikers Island. The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Damian Williams, has told a federal judge he's alarmed by the, quote, extraordinary level of violence and disorder at the jails, unquote. In January, prisoners at Rikers staged a hunger strike to protest deplorable conditions inside, citing the rapid spread of COVID, inadequate heating, and a growing level of violence. 16 people have died at the jail last year. In news from Michigan, more details have emerged about the police killing of Patrick Leoya, a 26-year-old Congolese refugee who was shot dead after a traffic stop on April 4th. An independent autopsy has determined that the Grand Rapids police officer who killed him first pressed his gun against the back of Leoya's head before shooting him. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump spoke at a press conference Tuesday.
Well, today, based on scientific evidence, we can confirm that Patrick Leoya was shot in the back of his head. That is now scientific evidence of this tragic killing and what his family believes was an execution.
A federal judge in Minnesota has sentenced a St. Paul man to a year in prison for threatening House Speaker Nancy Pelosi shortly after the January 6th insurrection. Meanwhile, a Donald Trump supporter in Florida has pleaded guilty to federal charges. He threatened to kill Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar 3 years ago. And in labor news, workers at five Starbucks stores in Richmond, Virginia, have overwhelmingly voted to unionize. Senator Bernie Sanders praised the news, tweeting, quote, "The movement of workers demanding dignity on the job wins again." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show in Kabul, Afghanistan, where a prominent boys' high school was targeted by two deadly bombings in the heart of the city's Shiite Hazara community. The blast struck students as they were leaving class Tuesday morning. This is a witness.
My nephew attends this school. When the blast happened, I ran out to see what was going on here, and I saw the students running out of the houses. There were a lot of people outside the school gate, and then another blast took place.
Western media reports at least 6 people were killed and 20 injured by the 2 blasts, but witnesses and Hazara leaders say at least 126 people were killed in yesterday's suicide attack and at least 73 people wounded. Many were teenage students. No group has claimed responsibility yet. The attacks are similar to previous strikes credited to ISIS-K, the Afghan branch of the Islamic State. For more on this and the security situation in Afghanistan under the Taliban, we're joined by Bilal Sarwari, Afghan journalist who reported on Afghanistan from Kabul for 20 years. He fled the country after the Taliban takeover last year, joining us now from Toronto. Bilal, welcome back to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for joining us. Can you explain the significance of what took place yesterday? Talk specifically about the community that was targeted and what this means for Afghanistan.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again. This was a brutal and deadly attack targeting students from the Hazara and Shia community in the Dasht-e-Barshi neighborhood. A neighborhood that has actually been targeted time and again, whether you talk about the Republic or whether you talk about the Taliban in power. And this was a massacre. I mean, parents working as drivers, parents who are farmers from central Afghanistan, from Hazarajat, were investing in the education of their children. They simply hope that they will be the doctors and engineers and future leaders of Afghanistan. Instead, they were murdered, some of them, or missing body parts are the only remains that parents have. And what we also see is a failure now for nearly 20, 21 years where the Hazara community, the Shias, are not protected, that they are being targeted for being Hazaras. So you kind of feel, the pain for Hazaras because they are being targeted for who they are. But at the same time, we also see the Taliban jealously and forcefully guarding a narrative that suits them, a narrative where they say Afghanistan is an island of perfection under the Taliban, everything is okay. And even if you look at the official accounts of what happened yesterday, the Taliban were very, very quick to downplay this incident. And we also saw Taliban soldiers actually beating some of the relatives of the victims, and they also prevented people from donating blood. So it is, quite heartbreaking to see, the Hazaras being treated in such manner.
And Bilal, could you talk about how large is the Hazara community within Afghanistan? And also, although we don't know for sure that it was the Islamic State that was responsible, there's a lot of suspicion that they were behind it. How have the Taliban been dealing with the Islamic State? Has it been growing in size, or what's been the government's policy toward them?
Well, the Hazaras and Shias are the beating heart of Afghanistan. This is a community that has invested in education. Their students coming from places like Bamiyan, from Daikundi and Ghazni, have dedicated themselves trying to, get the education. So they're extremely hardworking. And throughout the history of Afghanistan, they have actually been, the victims of many great injustices. But over the last 20 years, they were a very prominent and key part of, the post-Taliban Afghanistan. As far as the Islamic State is concerned, they have a presence in eastern Afghanistan. They have been in silent recruiting mood, buying weapons from the black market, but also from some Taliban commanders who are selling them. It's almost an open secret. And the, presence of the Islamic State in northern Afghanistan is actually there. And there's a risk that certain Taliban commanders, especially the non-Pashtun ones, would be joining the Islamic State. So this is a major threat to the Taliban as a government, but they're also a major threat in terms of having the foreign fighters, the flow from places like Syria over the last 8-9 months when the Taliban took over. The Taliban would like you to believe that they have a fix for this. The Taliban would like you to believe that they could defeat, Daesh, the Islamic State. But that is easier said than done. If you just look at also news coming out that the Islamic State launched a rocket into Uzbekistan from northern Afghanistan, that's actually something that has happened for the first time over the last 20 years. So you have this, regional, fear coming from Afghanistan. The region is extremely scared. What happens now that the Taliban also are hosting thousands of foreign fighters from Al-Qaeda and other transnational jihadi groups, not to forget the fact that the Taliban have officially opened suicide battalions and brigades within their interior ministry, within their defense ministry. So this is a massive, conundrum for the region, which I would like to call the regional conundrum. And the Taliban have so far failed to really regain the trust of the neighboring countries. Forget about the international community. Forget about the Afghan people, that they have really been cracking down against.
And speaking of the neighboring community, Pakistan, the Shia community in Pakistan has also been targeted in recent years. Could you talk about what is happening there? And it looks like it might be Islamic State people as well attacking in Pakistan.
Well, if we look at, the history of the last, let's say, 30 years or so, there has been also a number of militant extremist Sunni groups, Lashkar Jhangvi and many others inside Pakistan that have targeted, the Shia communities from Quetta to Parachinar in the, former tribal areas. And this community, remains extremely vulnerable from these militant groups. But in Afghanistan specifically, where I followed this deadly trend, the governments, I must also say governments, not only the Taliban, have failed to come up with a strategy where they could provide security to the Hazaras and Shias. I remember during the, Republic's time, even weapons were handed over to the community in Kabul because the government said, look, we simply cannot provide security, so you have to do it for yourself. And you have to actually also ask the question, why is it that there has been dozens and dozens of these deadly attacks happening in one specific area, Dasht-e-Barchi in West Kabul, which is predominantly, a Shia and Hazara community and area where they've been residing. So I call it, a great betrayal, towards, people that are extremely committed to a brighter future of Afghanistan.
And can you talk about what's happening to girls and education? This area, this neighborhood, was the site of the bombing of a girls' school last year. And you have the latest news of the Taliban closing schools for girls above sixth grade just hours after they reopened, Bilal.
Well, what we have seen in Afghanistan is full-scale Talibanization. If we go back to August 15th, since the Taliban took over power militarily, we were told that this is Taliban 2.0. We were told that the Taliban have changed, The reality is the Taliban have banned music. The Taliban have banned, all forms of entertainment. The Taliban have cracked down on Afghan media. The Taliban have also now banned, the education for girls. I mean, there are all sorts of excuses if you listen to the Taliban. But the reality is that this is an ideological, issue for the Taliban. They simply do not want to allow it. And what we also see is the most powerful Taliban, the ideological ones, those who are calling the shots, are against it. So you have certain Taliban leaders, especially the younger ones, taking this issue onto social media and saying, actually, this is great injustice. I want my daughters to be educated. And it's actually quite depressing at the moment because Afghanistan is a country where millions of girls will not be able to, achieve their dreams of becoming doctors and engineers and, teachers. And if you look at the last 20 years, the Afghan women have played a massive role in rebuilding the country, and especially people who were born in 1998, 99, 2000, they are actually today the leaders. They are today people who have successfully represented Afghanistan all over the world, but also have played a very important role in Afghanistan. And, you know, I feel so sorry and I feel so helpless, you know, as an Afghan to see that education is not a choice. Education is not available, not only to Afghan girls specifically, but also to a larger, you know, part of the Afghan community.
And yet, with all this, Bilal, you have this week 40 organizations, including Unfreeze Afghanistan, 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, writing a letter to President Biden urging him to reverse his decision to block the Afghan Central Bank from accessing $7 billion of Afghanistan's money held in the United States to prevent this looming humanitarian catastrophe of hunger. Can you respond as we wrap up?
Well, this is, you know, part of the consistent failures of the Biden administration, how he, you know, conducted things in Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan could have had a peace process. Afghanistan could have had a comprehensive and permanent ceasefire. And in the manner that, you know, he ordered the evacuation in the 11th hour. But it is also the responsibility of the Taliban. It's now on the Taliban. They're not the insurgency. They're the government. They have to do good by the people of Afghanistan. They have to treat the people of Afghanistan respectfully, and they have to actually regain the trust of the international community. And when you speak about, you know, the unfreezing, people like myself have lost money, you know, that I had trusted the banks with. So the money actually belongs to the people of Afghanistan, and at some stage you would kind of hope that there would be a sensible and logical solution coming out. And Afghanistan today is facing extreme levels of poverty. Millions of Afghans are facing the risk of mass starvation. And that in itself is the tragedy of 21st century. And it actually shows you what a waste it was over the last 20 years, you know, investing billions of dollars, all that sacrifices. And the end result is the epic failure that we are experiencing today.
Bilal Sarwar, we want to thank you for being with us, Afghan journalist who reported from Afghanistan for 20 years. He's continuing to report, but he left the country after the Taliban takeover last year and is now in Toronto, Canada. Next up, we go to the border to speak with an immigration lawyer about how U.S. border officials have arrested a record 1 million asylum seekers in the past 6 months, while at the same time welcoming thousands of Ukrainian refugees fleeing Russia's invasion, a number of them coming up through the southern border. Stay with us.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo, cambia el modo de pensar, cambia todo en este mundo, cambia el clima con los años, cambia el pastor su rebaño, y así como todo cambia, que yo cambie no es extraño.
Gina Chavez, Todo Cambia, Everything Changes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the U.S.-Mexico border, where Border Patrol officers have arrested over a million asylum seekers in the past 6 months, a record number in at least 20 years that comes as many are fleeing economic and political crises, horrific violence, the impacts of the climate emergency in Haiti and Cuba and Central and South America and Africa. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in late February, thousands of Ukrainian refugees have also trekked to the U.S.-Mexico border in search of safety. U.S. border officials have processed nearly 10,000 Ukrainians in the past 2 months, most at ports of entry. Hundreds of Ukrainians camped out in the border city of Tijuana, Mexico, earlier this month, hoping to be allowed into the United States.
I couldn't cry in Ukraine. I didn't cry in Ukraine at all. I thank you even for my tears. I thank you for this place, for this food, and for our dream to give him a little bit calmer life until the victory. When the victory comes, we will go the same day. The same day to Ukraine.
Little by little, the camp started being formed because this is going to go on for a long time. As long as the war continues, as long as there is no direct connection from Europe to the United States for the Ukrainians, they will continue to arrive here in Tijuana. They will have to depend on the charity and generosity of the people of Tijuana.
In addition to the camp at the border, Ukrainian refugees are also staying at a shelter in Tijuana.
I'm really surprised about how people have been helping us here. The conditions of the shelter are perfect. The most impressive thing is how Mexican and American people are trying to help us and how everybody wants to offer us assistance somehow.
Immigrant justice advocates have welcomed efforts to process Ukrainian refugees at the border, but are condemning the U.S. government's hypocrisy as it brutalizes and criminalizes Black, Indigenous, and other asylum seekers who don't come from white European nations. Many have waited months, even years, to be processed for asylum at a U.S. port of entry, forced to wait in Mexico, often in very dangerous conditions. This is a Honduran asylum seeker at a shelter in Tijuana, Mexico.
They got a war. We got worse than war in Central America. And they have a war from February to this time. We got a war there with these gangs, you know what I mean, about 15, 20 years behind. And we have that war, same bullet killed those people, same bullet killed us also, you know what I mean? Why they treating the Spanish asylum people this way? I mean, they can take all the Ukrainian people into the United States, but they don't take the Spanish people.
For more, we're joined by Erica Pinheiro, an immigration attorney based in Tijuana, Mexico, and the policy and litigation director of Al Otro Lado, a binational nonprofit helping asylum seekers on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. She herself was targeted by the Trump administration, monitored and surveilled. Erica, if you can talk about this double standard, what it looks like where you are in Tijuana. We're not talking about Ukrainians who are coming, flying into the United States where they can find, you know, a lot of bureaucracy. So they, too, are coming through the southern border, but they're allowed in.
Yes. Hi. We've seen thousands of Ukrainians coming through Tijuana. Their trips to Mexico are mostly financed by families and church groups in the United States who help them fly from Europe to Mexico City or Cancun and then onward to Tijuana. Volunteer groups are standing by at the airport. They're coordinating with CBP to give Ukrainians a number on a list. And CBP, Customs and Border Protection, are processing up to 1,000 Ukrainians per day at a port of entry where border officials claimed they did not have capacity to even process 30 other asylum seekers per day for the past few years. The Tijuana government has also provided an enormous amount of resources to Ukrainian migrants, even giving them a municipal funded shelter where they have food, shelter, bedding, all kinds of services available to them. Months after they evicted violently a camp of Black and Indigenous asylum seekers who had camped at the border for more than a year waiting for their chance to seek asylum, many of whom have now ended up homeless on the streets of Tijuana.
And Erica, these reports are astounding. I've heard reports that there was a special line set up at the border crossing in Tijuana for just for Ukrainians, sort of like a TSA line, a special priority line. Is that true?
That is accurate. So part of the port of entry was closed down when Title 42, the COVID-related border restrictions, were put into place in March of 2020. Customs and Border Protection has since reopened this section of the port of entry, and it is solely dedicated to humanitarian processing of Ukrainians. As I mentioned, up to 1,000 are being transported there each day by church groups and are being processed in a very orderly fashion by CBP. So this shows us that border officials do have the capacity to humanely process thousands of asylum seekers if they have the political will to do so.
And the impact on others who are waiting, for instance, Hondurans and Guatemalans, there are appear to be more Ukrainians being processed for asylum in a few weeks than an entire year of Salvadorans and Hondurans who have been admitted for asylum into the United States, despite decades of having some of the highest homicide rates in the world in El Salvador and in Honduras. What's the impact on those who are waiting and watching this?
Well, I can say for myself and also on behalf of many of the migrants with whom we work, everyone wants to support the Ukrainians. Of course, the war that they're fleeing is horrific. The way that they are being treated at the border is the way that everyone should be treated. So migrants who've been waiting for years now in deplorable conditions, many of whom have suffered rape, attempted kidnappings, assaults while waiting in these dangerous Mexican border cities, are, of course, you know, hurt and angry at seeing Ukrainians being processed at this clip while they are left waiting. But it's worse than that, actually. Since Ukrainians and even Russians have been coming to Tijuana in particular, whereas other asylum seekers could approach the border and ask for protection previously, you know, of course, they would be turned away. But now Mexican law enforcement officials are posted at the border with an immigration van. If a Honduran even tries to approach border officials, they will be arrested and detained in a Mexican immigration prison for even attempting to seek safety in the United States.
Erica, Axios reported on Tuesday that President Biden's inner circle has been discussing delaying the repeal of Title 42 border restrictions now set to end May 23rd. Again, these are the Trump-era pandemic restrictions that prevent people from coming into the United States on public health safety grounds. And these have been suspended for Ukrainians. But if you can talk about the number of Democrats and Republicans who have been demanding that Biden reimpose, extend Title 42, and what that means, as well as this double standard of Ukrainians not being subject to it as others are.
So part of the problem here is really the way that the media has been talking about the repeal of Title 42. I have seen numerous stories in which the migrants who have been waiting patiently at the border for the ports of entry to reopen have been characterized as a surge or a wave. I've seen, you know, language referring to the repeal of Title 42 as a crisis. Now, DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, estimates that approximately 25,000 asylum seekers are waiting at the border for Title 42 to be repealed. Now, again, keep in mind, in the past few weeks, U.S. border officials have processed over 10,000 Ukrainians. So again, they have the ability, the capacity to process the number of asylum seekers who are waiting at the border easily in an orderly and humane fashion when the political will is there. Of course, the only difference here is that those waiting are largely Black and Indigenous and, you know, other asylum seekers who are not white Europeans. So, you know, I really believe that we need to start speaking about the migrants who are waiting in a different way. I think that's a huge part of the problem. But it's really seeing that kind of rhetoric in the media and seeing that repeated by members of Congress who frankly should know better is extremely disappointing. And it's really dehumanizing for folks who have been waiting patiently at the border for it to reopen.
And Erica, there appears to be not only clearly a racial context to this border policy, but also a political or foreign policy context. As I understand it, there's been a significant increase in over the past year in the number of Cubans crossing into the United States along the Mexican border and getting asylum. We saw, for instance, back in the Central American War period, that Nicaraguans who were fleeing from the Sandinista rule got much more higher percentage of asylum grants from the United States than did Salvadorans and Guatemalans. What's your sense of the political that basically the United States favors granting asylum to refugees from those countries for which it politically supports?
That's always been the case with asylum. Asylum is supposed to be a universal standard protecting individuals fleeing persecution from any country. But in practice, it's always been a political tool wielded by the United States to favor those fleeing regimes that the United States opposes. Now, it's actually really interesting with the Ukrainians. The United States does not grant asylum for general conditions in a country. So generally, I could not get asylum as a Ukrainian just because my country is at war. Most of these asylum seekers, the 10,000 who've been processed from Ukraine, actually probably wouldn't qualify for asylum under U.S. law. Whereas many of those who are turned away, including Russians who are fleeing the same conflict, I've spoken with dozens of Russians here in Tijuana who protested the war against Ukraine, have been brutally repressed by the Putin regime, fled, the same issue, and have been turned away from ports of entry and are waiting here in Tijuana. Now, they would actually qualify for asylum under U.S. law, but are being turned away under the Title 42 policy. So I think there's two things happening here. One is certain nationalities are being allowed to even access humanitarian protections in the United States while others are being turned away. And then once in the United States, whether or not they gain asylum is really a political question rather than a legal one.
And of course, the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was born in Cuba, is a Cuban refugee in the United States. I wanted to ask you about the fact that you have Ukrainians giving shelter in indoor facilities, while Haitians, Central Americans, and others have had to sleep on the streets or makeshift camps outside ports of entry. And finally, to ask you yourself, Erica, the kind of work that you're doing. The Trump administration, right, the ACL sued on your behalf because you were targeted by the Trump administration as they monitored and surveilled your immigration advocacy work. If there's a difference under the Biden administration.
I have seen signs that, very clear signs that the surveillance of my work continues under the Biden administration. Of course, it's not to the same extent that it was under the Trump administration, during which I was detained in Mexico, removed from Mexico at the behest of the U.S. government. I'm now in a very different position where we are in more of a stakeholder relationship with the Biden administration. But just with respect to the situation right now, I can tell you that Had I done, or even if I today would do for a Central American migrant, what Ukrainian Americans or others helping the Ukrainians are doing for the Ukrainians, I would be in federal prison. And I will give you an example. These trips, like I mentioned, are being financed by U.S. citizens. In many cases, U.S. citizens have put Ukrainian refugees in their cars and driven them up to border officials. I absolutely believe that we should do everything we can to help people fleeing unspeakable violence, including the Ukrainians. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that. But again, had I done the same thing, or would I do the same thing for a Haitian migrant? If I put them in my car and just drove up to the border, I would be put in prison for smuggling. So even that double standard where, those helping white migrants are given unfettered access to the ports of entry, are given, are processed at a clip of 1,000 a day, where those of us trying to organize on behalf of Black and brown migrants are persecuted for the same activities. It's really just, it's hurtful, honestly, and it's really astounding to see it play out like this.
Erica Pignato, I want to thank you for being with us, immigration attorney, policy and litigation director of Al Otro Lado, a binational nonprofit helping immigrants on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, speaking to us from Tijuana. Next up, in 1 week, Texas plans to execute Melissa Lucio. She'd be the first Latina to be put to death in Texas. We speak to the Innocence Project lawyer who's fighting to save her life. Stay with us.
En el canto de las olas encontré un rubor de luz. Por un canto de gaviotas supe que allí estabas tú. Despidiendo últimamente todo lo que sucedió. Hoy saludo mi presente y gusto de este dulce adiós. Voy a navegar en tu puerto azul. Quisiera saber de dónde vienes tú. Vamos a dejar que el tiempo pare. Ver nuestros recuerdos en los mares.
Soldad y el Mar by Natalia Lafourcade. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 1 week from today, Texas plans to execute Melissa Lucio for the death of her daughter, despite widespread concern she's innocent. A bipartisan group of over 100 Texas lawmakers is among those calling to spare Lucio's life, led in part by Republican State Representative Jeff Leach, who visited Lucio on death row and hosted a hearing on her case.
What you're going to hear from my colleagues today is a succinct but detailed and very important outline of the problems that we see. And that we believe that you will see the problems that we believe are clearly evident with Melissa Lucio's case. As a conservative Republican myself, who has long been a supporter of the death penalty in the most heinous cases, I have never seen a more troubling case than the case of Melissa Lucio. And the six of us, in conjunction with our House colleagues, and hopefully many more who will join later today and in the days ahead, are asking for the Board of Pardons and Paroles to spare her life.
Melissa Lucio is a mother of 14 children. She says she was wrongfully convicted of killing her 2-year-old daughter, Mariah, after a tragic accident in 2007. Police blamed Lucio for Mariah's death after she called them to say the girl was unresponsive 2 days after falling down a flight of stairs. Lucio's lawyers say she faced a lifetime of abuse, was pressured to make a false confession, and did not get a fair trial. Attorneys with the Innocence Project have asked the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles and Texas Court of Criminal Appeals to halt her execution in order to review new evidence that could prove Lucio's innocence. Five of Lucio's trial jurors now oppose her execution. This is juror Johnny Galvin speaking via his daughter.
The idea that my decision to take another person's life was not based on complete and accurate information in a fair trial is horrifying.
Lucio would be the first Latina woman executed by Texas. She spoke to the Spanish-language news outlet Agencia Efe on Texas death row earlier this month.
I'm scared, but I'm scared for my children. I'm scared that that nobody's going to be there to support them if this execution goes through. I worry for them. But I know that right now there's many people who are supporting them, that have encouraged them. And many of my friends have said to me that, you know, if this execution does go through, that they will be there for my children. And I'm very grateful for that.
Lucio's children have long claimed she was innocent and are calling for her release. Now some say they're starting to prepare for the worst. This is Lucio's eldest son, John.
I want to see my mom for the last minute. I don't want to see my mom die. But if I have to see her, I mean, I would like to see her for the last breath.
For more, we're joined by Vanessa Potkin, Director of Special Litigation at the Innocence Project, one of Melissa Lucio's attorneys. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you lay out the new evidence that could prove Lucio's innocence?
Thank you for having me. Yes, it is, you know, quite incredible that here we are 7 days away from Ms. Lucio's scheduled execution. And despite this groundswell of support that you mentioned earlier, you know, there's nothing as we sit here today that's standing in the way of this execution going forward in 7 days. The Innocence Project joined Melissa Lucio's legal team at the end of January after her execution date was set. And we had learned about Ms. Lucio's case and were so disturbed by the fact that her conviction rests on faulty scientific evidence, and we recognize the urgency that an innocent woman was, you know, was headed to be put to death. At her trial, the state presented evidence from a medical examiner that the injuries to Mariah, Ms. Lucio's 2-year-old child, had to come from intentional abuse and had to have happened within 24 hours of when her child died. That testimony completely undermined Ms. Lucio's defense and what she's been saying all along, that Mariah fell down the stairs and then increasingly, you know, started to get lethargic and sleepy. And then the family was increasingly concerned. And ultimately, she just, you know, went unresponsive. That testimony that was presented at her trial was absolutely false. And in fact, a review of the medical evidence and the autopsy results show that all of the injuries that Mariah incurred were completely consistent with an accidental fall.
And could you, Vanessa, could you talk about this, her confession, why this was a false confession? And how it may have occurred?
Absolutely. So police rushed to judgment as soon as paramedics responded to the scene. They started to make judgments about Ms. Lucio and about how she was presenting. And it's so egregious because Ms. Lucio was a victim of sexual abuse as a child and domestic abuse, you know, throughout her life. And you know, some of the way that she presented was directly related to, you know, PTSD. And so not only did she endure these experiences, but then they ended up being used against her when she's enduring the most unimaginable thing of her daughter being unresponsive and dying. Within 2 hours of her daughter's death, police had her in an interrogation room. They started berating her, telling her that she had to have done this. She must have been responsible for her child's death, showing her pictures of her daughter, threatening her, saying she wasn't going to go to her daughter's funeral unless she told them what they wanted to hear. Over 100 times, Ms. Lucio asserted her innocence, and police ignored it. They interrupted her. They stopped her. They told her it wasn't true. And the clear implication was, this interrogation is not going to stop until you tell us what we want to hear. She endured that type of aggressive, coercive, manipulative questioning for over 5 hours before ultimately she falsely took responsibility for some of her daughter's injuries. And then this was used against her at trial as a confession. Her statements and the interrogation have been reviewed by the world's leading expert on false confessions and suggestibility, and also a certified forensic investigator who trains police officers and law enforcement departments throughout the country on how to conduct interrogations. And both found the statement to be completely unreliable and just a mere regurgitation of what the officers were telling her throughout the interrogation.
And you argue in the petition that Mariah's death was declared a murder before the autopsy even began. Could you talk about how police officers may have influenced the coroner as well?
Absolutely. So what happened here is that after the interrogation, the following day, Mariah's autopsy was conducted, and two of the officers who interrogated Ms. Lucio were present during the autopsy. And so they, the medical examiner went into the autopsy with the knowledge that Ms. Lucio confessed and that the police believed that this was a homicide and Ms. Lucio was responsible and had taken responsibility. And so while child abuse is a diagnosis of exclusion, that's not what happened here. It wasn't that the medical examiner systematically looked at Mariah's injuries and tried to determine what were potential causes. For example, Mariah had profound bruising throughout her body, and the medical examiner overlooked or ignored clear signs that Mariah was experiencing what's called DIC, a coagulation disorder that happens after accidental head trauma quite frequently and causes profound bruising throughout the body. Those indications were clear and present during the autopsy, but the medical examiner ignored it and said the bruising had to come from intentional abuse. And so you had a really biased and inadequate autopsy. It wasn't, we can't even call it a death investigation because it wasn't an investigation. It was a procedure aimed at amassing evidence to support a prosecution of Ms. Lucio at that point.
So how significant is it, Vanessa, that you, I mean, you hardly have bipartisanship in this country today, but a bipartisan group of more than 80 members of the Texas House of Representatives, 20 state senators have asked the Texas Board of Pardons and Parole to grant Lucio clemency, coming after a hearing in which they called on the Cameron County DA to cancel her April 27th death date. He testified in the hearing, if Lucio doesn't get a stay, quote, I will do what I have to do and stop it. What does this all mean?
Well, right now that means nothing because he hasn't done anything and nobody else has done anything to stop this execution going forward. And if the DA wanted to put a pause on this execution so that Ms. Lucio's evidence of innocence can be fully litigated in court, he could move for that today. The district attorney has the power to withdraw the execution, to move to withdraw the execution. The district attorney has the power to agree to a stay, a pause of the execution, so that the courts can consider this new evidence of innocence, which no court has ever considered. And as you pointed out, the jurors felt was so relevant that they believe, many of them, that Ms. Lucio deserves a new trial. So the district attorney could take action right now. I mean, this bipartisan support that we have from, you know, over 100 members of the Texas legislature, Republicans, Democrats, it's unprecedented. You don't see this. You don't see bipartisan support. You don't see legislators stepping out to try to, you know, really make sure an execution doesn't go forward. And that speaks to the evidence of Ms. Lucio's innocence and the fact that it doesn't matter what you think about the death penalty. People do not want to see an innocent person executed. And everyone who has looked at the case, over 100, you know, state legislators feel that there is a significant risk that that is going to happen if Ms. Lucio's execution goes forward.
And we have only about a minute, but could you talk about some of the jurors, of five jurors who are in the original trial, who now have grave concerns about evidence that was withheld?
Yeah, well, the jurors, you know, feel that they were misled, that they didn't get the full picture. They are, you know, speaking out. And I would just encourage, you know, people who are watching to go to SaveMelissa.org. There's, you know, people who want to express, you know, support can there, you know, through that contact Governor Abbott. Ultimately, there's two ways this execution can stop. One is the Board of Pardons and Paroles can recommend clemency. It will be up to Governor Abbott to make that determination. Or even without a recommendation from the board, he could grant a reprieve so that the evidence of Ms. Lucio's innocence can be considered in the courts. And also the Court of Criminal Appeals can issue a stay so that this doesn't go forward. But right now, we're 7 days away from Ms. Lucio's execution. And again, nothing is standing in the way until somebody acts.
Well, we will certainly continue to follow this case. Vanessa Potkin, Director of Special Litigation at the Innocence Project, one of Melissa Lucio's attorneys. And that does it for our show. We end with some wonderful news. Congratulations to Democracy Now! Producer Tammy Warnoff and her partner David Rowley on the birth of their son. Welcome to the world, Felix Shin Warnoff Rowley, our newest Democracy Now! News bunny. And that does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is immediate opening for a news writer-producer. Visit democracynow.org/jobs to find out more and apply. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood Ra, Mary Conlin, and Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
DJ Heim from Forst, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Diese Folge wurde von Vonage produziert. Eine herausragende Kundenerfahrung lässt sich mit drei Buchstaben beschreiben. API. Mit den Vonage Voice und Video APIs können Kunden Anrufe über ihre App oder Website ausführen oder einen ausführlichen Videoanruf durchführen. Sie können außerdem mit der Zwei-Faktor-Authentifizierung der Vonage Verify API Bots und Hacker stoppen. Es ist wirklich einfach. Optimieren Sie die Kundenerfahrung mit den Vonage Communications APIs. Testen Sie sie kostenlos oder besuchen Sie vonage.com, um mehr zu erfahren.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett, and I have a movie recommendation that's going to appeal to every word nerd. It's a brand new movie. It's called The Palindromists, and it's a documentary about the 2017 World Palindrome Championships. Of course, as you know, a palindrome is a word or a phrase or a sentence that reads the same forward and backward, like Madam, I'm Adam, or No Lemons, No Melon. And the World Palindrome Championship is organized and emceed by our friend Will Schwartz, who's editor of the New York Times Crossword Puzzle. And this film features some of the best palindrome creators out there, like Mark Saltfight, who's the founder of the Palindromist magazine, and John Agee, who's author of such palindromic books as Go Hang a Salami, I'm a Lasagna Hog, and So Many Dynamos. And you get to follow the top competitors as they prepare for this contest, which takes place at the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament.
Of course it does.
Of course it does. It's like Nerd Central. What's fun is that the championship itself is a real nail biter because the top contestants have limited time to come up with original palindromes that adhere to any of several constraints, like on a particular current events topic or on a particular movie, or maybe the first and last word of the palindrome have to be from a foreign language. And what's really fun is that they do this in front of a whole audience, and the audience votes by holding up paddles that say wow on one side, which is a palindrome, and huh on the other side if the palindrome doesn't make a lot of sense.
H-U-H, another palindrome. Yeah. Nice. You get instant response. Boy, you know you've really stunk up the room if you get a lot of huns in your direction.
Yeah, and that happens sometimes, and it's painful because, you know, a really good palindrome is going to be something that makes sense and conjures images. It's a wonderful film. It's really entertaining, and it answers some of the questions that you might have, like, who are these people, and how do they do what they do, and why do they do what they do? Oh, and the winner gets a check for, of course, $1,001, because that's a palindrome.
Yeah, we watched it in my house, and my 14-year-old son, Guthrie, he also enjoyed it, and we immediately got interested in palindromes and started looking up palindromes and talking about how to make palindromes. So it's a family movie, too. It's great fun. And there are clips from it on YouTube if you want to take a taste of it, or you can find more about the movie. I believe the website is thepalindromists.com.
Yeah, and we'll share some more later in the show.
This is a show for word nerds. This is a welcoming environment. We talk about all aspects of language, and we welcome your calls 24/7, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 1-877-929-9673. And we'll take your emails from anywhere in the world, words@waywardradio.org. And hey, talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Who is this?
This is Sam. Is this Grant?
Yep, sure. This is Grant. Where are you calling from, Sam?
Nice to meet you. Abilene, Texas.
Well, welcome to the show.
I've always wondered, because my mother, when I was little, we'd be in the grocery store, for instance. She'd yank me out of the toy section, and we'd go to the checkouts, and I'd be bored to tears. And leaning up against her, she'd gently push me away, and she'd always tell me, lean on your own dinner. Well, my thoughts were, Mom, I'm not going to eat you. So what do you mean? I know she didn't want me to lean on her. But I was just wondering if anyone had ever come across that, if anybody else was told that when they were little, to lean on their own dinner.
Lean on their own dinner. So you're hanging on to your mama.